You have just continued to be an entrepreneur and create companies. Let me ask you two questions. What formed your attitudes about the importance of earning and growing money? First, you know, for you, but then also for everybody else. You're truly passionate about teaching people how to be smart with their money. Where did that passion come from?
Well, Betsy, first I want to start off. I think, and I suspect, that everyone in this room is connected probably to an entrepreneur somehow. Probably that foundation you're associated with is probably formed by some crazy entrepreneur someplace along the line. And my contention is that really wealth in America has created every company you can think of, whether it's Ford Motor Company or Google or Apple, was formed originally by some entrepreneur. Somebody who sort of stepped out, had an idea to go do something. And so in my case, it was sort of like probably most entrepreneurs. It starts out with a little bit of necessity. In my particular case, I was old enough to say that my parents were of the Depression, the last one, not the present one, the last one, in the 30s. And so when I was in the 1940s and 50s and so forth, money was very limited in our family. My dad was a country lawyer, and he made a living, but that was about it. And so limitations were huge around money things. And I said, man, I want to figure this thing out because I don't want to be living that way all my life. I've got to figure out how money or how resources are created. And so, fortunately, I focused a lot on that, trying a lot of different things. And, of course, my first ambition was bagging walnuts, put them in there, and saw them down at the general store where they bought these things in large 100-pound sacks for $5. So that was my first entry into this incredible world of for-profit world. And then I said, well, that's not quite good enough because that's only basically in the fall when the nuts are falling out of the trees. And I go around and pick these things up all over. Woodland, California is the place I was brought up in. It's a little town of about 5,000 people in Central California. So, hey, there's something else that's better than that. So, and then I moved to chickens, which I could do around the year. And I could do a bunch of different things. I could use their eggs. I could use their droppings and such. I could sack that up and sell that to the housewives around to the gardens, and I could also, at the end of a useful life, I could also have them as fryers, and I could sell those to the housewives around town. So I had, as I said, my first integrated business at about 11 years of age. I don't know how profitable it was. I never kept the books. Probably if you asked my father, he probably said maybe it wasn't that profitable. At least I thought it was. So that's how it all began, Betsy.
I'm going to ask you in a few minutes about the economy and challenges for businesses today. But back when you were starting, particularly Charles Schwab Corp., what were your major obstacles facing an entrepreneur like yourself, and how difficult was it to get capital? What were the challenges then?
Well, Betsy, the beauty about starting, and I use the word in a loose way, crazy entrepreneurs, most of us don't really know the challenges that we're going to be facing. We have an idea. In my case, it was I knew people who wanted to buy and sell, participate in investing, and who could save a lot of money by doing it the way we ended up starting our company in 1974. And then it grew in its complexities and all that later on. But the idea was saving money, doing it highly efficiently, and not having some stockbroker selling you a bad idea every time the transaction were happening. You could just do it on your own initiative. You could figure out reading Forbes magazine or Fortune magazine or Wall Street Journal, something like that, come up with a good idea and be able to buy it on your own without the effort or without oversight by some very self-serving broker. So that was the origins, the genesis of the whole thing. And you know, it, we didn't have any money. That's one of the first things you learn as an entrepreneur. You have never enough money. You can't ever hire the right people that you want to have. You know what you need, but you can't afford it. And then you move on and you find out, well, if I just expand a little bit more, I could, we could make a little bit more of the bottom line. And then you forget, well, I've got to find some investment capital to, you know, open the next office, we'll say, or get the next computer, although we didn't have any computers back when we started. It was mostly manual, for the most part, manual bus telephone. So it was a pretty primitive kind of thing, to say the least. Or now we'll do a million transactions in a day. Today, back then, if we were lucky, we were doing 20 or 30 in a day. So things have changed, to say the least. But so entrepreneurs have to have an unbelievable amount of optimism. You really can't go on this thing, and you got to be have a little bit, maybe not as the smartest guy in the school. Because the smart kids go off and become our doctors or lawyers. It's these, I always like to say, it's the C students that really build the dormitories, build the libraries. It's not, they don't, you know, the professors, the A students become the professors of the next generation. The C students build the university, which is probably pretty close to true.
So that leads to my next question. You are dyslexic. And that is, you want me to tell him now? That has threaded through a lot of your philanthropic efforts. I, for one, am very grateful that you were the first high profile person to come out and speak about that and explain, the strengths that accompany very often, the weaknesses of dyslexia. I'm going to get back to this in a minute, but right now, how did the strengths that come with the dyslexia, how did that inform your ability, you as you were starting this business? What did it enable you to do
to
make it successful?
I wish there was an answer. Actually, the dyslexia thing we'll get into, and that was actually the first activity that our foundation really got behind and did a lot of stuff in. Actually, it was 1990 and such. And we've changed a lot. But the dyslexia thing, I didn't really know my connection to it until my son was diagnosed with it when he was in the third grade. And by then, had already started the company. And so I was well into the company. We were probably 6 years, 7 years into the company, which I started in 1974, before I started. The light went on when I had him tested, because he was having real struggle in first and second grade. So, my God, this is the key. This is exactly what I was facing when I was in grammar school and high school and college and so forth. The same darn thing. But there wasn't much out there in the woodwork, not much in the way of science or conversation about it. And this is now talking about 1989, 1990, something like that, when Michael was diagnosed. And so, but when I look back on it, some of the issues here are some of the things that were probably helpful to me in starting the business and doing the business, that I had incredible confidence about my vision, which was somewhat suspect maybe looking back then. But so I had a lot of confidence, but I also had the confidence to surround myself with really smart people and understand that they were really good at this particular thing. I wasn't particularly good at that, or this, or that, or that, but I was good at the conceptualization of the whole thing. I could see what we needed to do and where we're going, all that stuff, way ahead of the people that were working with me at the time, and where we could go with the kind of things that we were doing at the time. So a dyslexic kid, I would hope all are the same. In some ways, they're sort of gifted with, they're not good on reading, they're not good on a lot of things, but they're pretty good on conceptualization. And that thing, that really helped me, I think, to sort of envision the business, envision where we were going, and then convince the other people that this was a great thing for them to do. And they learned sort of more sequentially, as opposed to the way I learned, which is a completely different way. It wasn't sequentially. I mean, I got things sort of screwed up, but I could see A to Z much more quickly because I didn't eliminate B to, you know, Y at times.
I remember you describing it as being able to see the end zone.
Yeah, and it upset a lot of people who I work with, but I calmed them down and said, this is, you know, this, we're going to get there. And they went through a methodical, sequential process and got to the same conclusion I did, but it was just, I was fortunate enough to see those things more quickly. And so anyway, that's been a positive. I'm hanging on to that. That's a positive. And one of the most important things about kids with this thing, make sure you keep their self-esteem as high as you can. So I sort of did it myself. My parents showed, they were not, it was not a thing that people studied or looked at. And they were always considered either slow or dumb or something happened. And that's what I grew up under, in that kind of a negative thing. Until new science has found some other reasons why these kids are this way.
I will ask you a question I was going to wait and ask later, but with some philanthropy questions, but I'll ask it now. The question is, how can a philanthropist make a difference? And I will preface that by saying that I can vouch firsthand how a philanthropist makes a difference, because Chuck and made a difference in my household and my personal experience. Chuck's willingness to kind of explain this to the world, and his and the foundation that gave so much support at the time, very focused on dyslexia and giving support to kids and their families, really did a couple of things. First of all, well, several things. First of all, it changed the perception of dyslexia in this country, I believe. And in my household, it prompted me to write a cover story for Fortune magazine about dyslexic CEOs and the very talented, a whole bunch of very talented CEOs, Chuck being one, John Chambers at Cisco being another, David Boyce, the kind of super lawyer, being a third, and I could go on and on. But that was one thing that it did. And the other thing that it did was, I think, really gave our son, who was very, very dyslexic at the time, really the hope that he needed to keep going. And my son is now a violin performance major at a conservatory in Boston. You never would have thought that at the time that I read the story. And I would say that if Chuck hadn't, if it weren't for Chuck, really, and Helen, we would have had a very different outcome in my family. So anyway, I wanted to give you the context for this discussion, which will go very quickly to the economy. But let me ask you that question right now, since we're talking about philanthropy and having an impact. What would you say?
I think one of the benefits of being the founder of our foundation and sort of being an owner and all that stuff and the original entrepreneur, we had the privilege of trying to figure out what we really wanted to do that would be impactful. Our budget was pretty limited. Actually, interesting enough, I think I probably put, I don't know if I put $1 million of stock into it. Maybe it was less than that, I don't know, but fortunately, successful entrepreneurship ended up being many, many millions, many hundreds of millions, eventually the same stock because of the growth of the company and so forth. So our impact grew as the stock grew, and that was terrific. Although I have to say the last 10 years have been a little rough, to say the least, for a lot of us, including me, and our philanthropy. But so anyway, we had the privilege of thinking through what could we do that could be impactful as opposed to sprinkling it all around? And of course, it seemed like a natural for us to start out with this dyslexia issue. And so we reached out to who we considered experts in that particular area and around the country at the time. As I said, early, late 89, 90, something like that. And we found different people, different capabilities, but not a lot of science, frankly, about it. And so we began supporting what we could, and we hired a PhD lady to run our thing. And so the first thing we did was to help families from the San Mateo County. There were probably 500 to 1,000 families that use our place every month. And so that was sort of cool that we could do that and see the real results. And we had some people, couples that came out, as I mentioned earlier today. They were PhDs, both the husband and wife, PhDs at Stanford. They couldn't believe the kid had this issue. I mean, two brilliant mom and dad. And it happens. It happens to about 1 in 7 kids, frankly, as you find out. Some level, not different degrees of learning differences, as we found out. Anyway, it was sort of a neat thing to do, and we did that really almost exclusively for the next 15 years. I did websites and all that, and we've since changed our focus, actually more education, more charter schools, more of that kind today. But early on, it was really fun to see the real, it was a operating foundation. It wasn't a gift-giving foundation, it was an operating. So that was pretty interesting. I enjoyed that at the time because as the sort of the founder and tied in with our son who was growing at the time, he was, you know, first 8 years of age, right on through to 12, 14. Had dinner with him the other night. He's 35 now. Still got the same issue, but as his father does. So we have lots in common.
And I might add also, the foundation really was the very first of its kind in that
It was
area.
Totally the first kind, and fortunately now, there are many organizations that help in the whole area, different components of it, about learning issues, learning differences, different kinds of handicaps and so forth. And that's great. But it came a time for us to make a shift because we were responsible, not completely, but we were sure enhanced the understanding and the awareness of learning issues. And so that was fun to do.
Let me turn now to the a subject that I think probably everybody wants to hear you on, and that is the economy and business. And I'm going to ask you several questions and just let you tackle them in whatever order you want. What mistakes what were the major mistakes that led to the financial crisis, and have they been adequately addressed?
Well, I have to tell you, just yesterday, if you have yesterday's Wall Street Journal, there's a short article that would explain it as probably as well as any you could probably point to. It was an editorial in the editorial section of the journal, written by a professor, I think, from Columbia. And he was talking about two things that were really combined. It was the low documents and no document loans that were started in 2000 and 2004, essentially, that were sort of mandated for Fannie and Freddie Mac, the big mortgage companies that are now in receivership. It really started out in 2004 and grew in greater and greater proportion. And it's sort of interesting to see the genesis and the conversation. This professor had sort of laid out some of the early participants, all with good intentions, of course. We wanted to get house ownership from, let's say, 65% of Americans to 70 or 73%, whatever that was. And so it was the beginning of that incredible bubble that happened. And, you know, there are many players that took part in this whole thing. But that was the genesis. It was really interesting. And I can go on and on and on about all the different players and components that led to the expansion of credit and then the bubble that occurred and all of that. But it's and so the consequence right now, we're all faced with the deleveraging that's going on. And it's very uncomfortable for everybody. And how long further will it go on? I'm not quite sure. Certainly the housing, we really haven't, we haven't dealt with the housing issue. And I was sort of amazed walking in here to this hotel. Many of you remember back in the crisis of the savings and loans back in the early 90s. This was a famous hotel. It was done by Charles Keating, who was well known at the time as being a man of great scandal because of what he did. It's a pretty good hotel, actually. Guy's in a striped suit someplace in prison, I think. Maybe he's still there. But that was the crisis, the savings loan crisis of the early 90s. And these things happen in America, and sometimes it seems as though our regulators are completely asleep and not seeing what's happening. It was pretty obvious to most of us in this room that these mortgages are going on. Anytime you turn on the TV, you could see you could get a loan. No documents down, no tax return, no nothing. You just had to call these people on this 800 number. It was all there. And I thought Greenspan, who was the chairman back in of the Federal Reserve in the 05 period, I don't think he ever looked at TV. He's such an intellectual. I don't think he ever looked at TV. I really don't. He would have seen, obviously, what we all saw at the time, that credit was just being extended to almost anybody. There was no discipline. And that was really the essence of, I think, and, of course, human beings, what they are. There's profit motivation on some of things and stupid things on the other thing, all that. It happened, and now we're paying the consequences from 07 to today in 2011. It will be a little bit of time further, but I wouldn't give up your stocks for sure. Those are, as I just like to say, they're for the long, long run, but they just happen to be down in price. They don't give up. Give it all up.
What do you believe is holding back the economy right now, and what is it going to take to reignite it?
Well, it might give away my political preference if I answer that question, but I'm going to try anyway and try to be as fair as I can. Certainly, the crisis wasn't created by anybody in the administration per se. There were some people that were players and different things, but not individually responsible. But I think when you lead anything, any enterprise, even the country, you've got to have it. It's got to start from the top. If you want to get out of this crisis, there are certain things you need to do, and you need leadership. And I frankly don't think we have the appropriate leadership to get us out of this crisis. It's not going to be done by the... Thank you. Sounds like I'm running for office. I'm not. I'm not asking for contributions, any of that. But I think that it's going to require a total change of leadership, because where we are all at, our confidence level is so down and the uncertainty level is so high. And, you know, what they both play off one another. And whether it's tax policy, healthcare policy, or Social Security policy, you name it, there's complete uncertainty about all these major issues. And as a consequence, there are companies that are doing fine, but small business in particular, which creates maybe 70-75% of real job formation, these people can't get credit. I mean, I tell you, you come go into almost any bank, and they'll tell you the same story. It's the regulators that just are over the top in terms of suppressing loan expansion. And judgment by the bankers. I mean, we're talking about small community banks now. And they are all over these guys. We have a bank, too, and I say it the same way. We just have regulators have now moved in. They move into most all the significant banks. and are there permanently. Talk about the kind of persuasion they have over our employees when they're in there all the time. You don't mind periodic audits and that kind of thing, which you should have, but not a permanent. It's like an octopus in your business, all the time there. They can answer, ask any question, they can do whatever they want to do, go any place they want to. It is oppressive. And they are first off with criticism. And bureaucracy is taking over banking, brokerage in the areas that I certainly know. And I'm sure small business doesn't have it. So they don't want to invest, frankly, because there's too many risks for them. They don't know what the health care costs are going to be per employee. They don't know what their taxes are going to be for their little business. They don't know, frankly, really what is going to happen. So why would you invest? And so this combination, this sort of circular thinking, leads to a huge uncertainty, and as a consequence, we're pretty much sort of moving sideways now.
And if you picture new leadership in Washington, what would you have? What did the new leaders need to do?
You know, confidence is so important. Just an attitudinal thing. And I talked about earlier about self-esteem. It's the attitude, whether it's the teacher for the student, a positive viewpoint about you or the kid, move on to the bigger theater, America. And it's got to be the confidence in the entrepreneurial spirit that this country is based upon. And this huge election is coming up. I think it's going to be a Teutonic shift one way or the other. Either we're going to go to our roots, which is what Charles talked about today at lunch, it's freedom, it's decision-making, it's innovation, all those great things that we really love and honor and cherish and reward and incentivize. Or it's going to be a large government oversight, which I see the beginnings in already, which I just talked about a moment ago. There's the choice. Which way do we want to go as a country? And I couldn't predict this moment how it's going to come out. So it's really for all of us to get out there and figure out and try to get people to vote for the people who will get us back to our roots as a country. All of you are here because of, as I said earlier, because of some innovation that happened someplace along the way by some entrepreneur creating wealth. I mean, the creation of wealth doesn't come from a government job. It never has. It comes from an idea. You think Steve Jobs, when he created the iTunes and iPhones and the i-this and i-that, those are ideas that were in this guy's mind or his group that are around him, and they create millions and billions of dollars of revenue. And nobody ever knew. You could have said last year or 10 years ago, all of a sudden it happened and everybody wants them now. iPads, which will be a next generational kind of thing and use in businesses for sure. So those are all from innovation, from ideas. And our leadership now would love to have, that's not the world he's thinking about. He's thinking about how can we create more post offices? How can we create more of those kinds of jobs, I think? Because I don't think I've ever heard him use the word intuition or innovation or entrepreneurship. That's not in his vocabulary. And so if our leader doesn't have that, how the hell does it happen? It doesn't happen. And that's what's happening right now to the country. We've lost it. It's still there in the country. It's still alive in the hearts and souls of people, but it's certainly not. It's not in the Washington area of the White House. I know that.
I've heard you talk in the past a lot about the role of small business. And I'm struck, kind of as I'm struck more and more at how it doesn't look like big business is going to, you know, be what leads us out. So can you speak a little bit about, explain why, and speak a little bit about the role of small business?
Well, small business, having run both small and large business, and we still try to keep at Schwab an entrepreneurial spark, but I can tell you how difficult it is at times to see bureaucratic things show up even in our company. I mean, we're 15,000 employees, I guess, and I'm still chairman and quite involved in the company. But how easy it was when we were a small company, making decisions quickly, finding out whether we were right or wrong, finding out from our customers right away whether we were making the right decision or the wrong decision, whether they buy it or not buy it. And that's what small business is able to do. It's able to deal with the marketplace, which is consumers, find out their likes and dislikes very quickly, serve them the way they want to be served, change your pricing, whatever you need to do to make them happy, and so forth. So I think, I love small business, and you know, in America we have something like 6 million small businesses. 6 million. We have in California, we have about not quite a million small businesses. And we're talking about businesses with, let's say, fewer than 500 employees. And that's certainly a major force, and it represents probably 75% of employment in America. But there are 6 million decision makers around the country, and they're held up. You ask any of them, I would venture to say, except maybe a few people, maybe Silicon Valley are selling components for the iPad. But from wherever you go, these people are going to say the same thing. They're down in attitude. They're uncertain about the future, all these things. And it's true. And so how that's going to change is going to change, I think, hopefully, with the explosion in the political scene. And we'll be able to sort of take back our country. I love David Brooks' book called The Battle. If you haven't read that, I think he spoke here yesterday or something. It is a great book to read. And I would highly recommend it. So, Betsy, when you think about what's happening, and then I would say, leave you with a positive thing. I just reviewed recently the whole thing about social media, the social networking stuff, Facebook, Twitter, those kinds of things. I think there's an element in that area that's going to be impactful to all of your, maybe not so much to your foundations, but all to your recipients. There's lots of stuff in there, I think, for the non-for-profit world that hasn't been even touched upon in any big way. And it's how it gives you an easy way to communicate with your beneficiaries, with your, both as the foundation and the ultimate users of those various services that you support. But I think that whole social thing is a big positive area to really be examined. And we're looking at
potentially growth creating?
A huge growth kind of thing, and huge ways to explain, and more effective ways to interact with your ultimate clientele, whether it's poverty or whether it's dyslexia people or whatever it might be that you're interested in, even in education. You'll hear, I think, tonight or tomorrow, Saul Khan about the Khan Academy. Great stuff. And I think he's talking about Anna.
Yeah, tonight.
Highly recommend. He's a great entertainment, too.
Let me ask you one more about this. What are your biggest worries about the economy right now? Debt, regulation, gridlock in Washington. How would you rank those?
Well, I rank it even something, in my mind, is sort of incompetence. I have to believe that what the Fed has done has really wiped out a generation of savers I mean, it's pitiful that there's no incentive anymore for saving. Your kids can't save a savings account, a checking account, all that stuff. The Federal Reserve has done this incredible experiment as such of zero rates for now 4 years, something like that. And the implications are really interesting because even they say, oh, it's, you can't point to too many people that really is helping. It's hurting a lot of people. It's hurting the economy. It's reducing income, particularly for the people who work so hard to get to near a retirement age. And that whole group is being impacted negatively because their money market accounts, their savings account, all that are zero, basically, in terms of. And they say, oh, we're helping the housing industry. Well, what's happened here is that we still have these things called Freddie and Fannie are still available. They're now owned by the government because of the takeover. But 95% of loans that you're going to get end up coming into a bank, and they go off right off to Freddie and Fannie. And they, of course, borrow on behalf with the government's name on it, so they're borrowing at near record low rates. And so it's sort of what's happening is all these things is government-oriented in almost every area that I can think of, and we're losing every day our origin, which was entrepreneurship, free enterprise, all the things that we so cherish, and every day we're just chipping away at that thing as fast as we possibly can. And so the Fed is supporting this vicious circle in terms of the Freddie and Fannie, in terms of the housing thing. You know, we've got the Obamacare is just beginning to be felt in by a number of institutions, and that will slowly peck away. Then you go on to, in my world, which is a disaster with respect to Dodd-Frank. I went back to see a bunch of my friends at Congress last week, and just the statute is that high, that wide, and that thing is a big, like, you know, two unabridged Webster dictionaries. And so that's the new statute. It's going to continue to prevent credit expansion by banks, put restrictions on them, probably, and even small little banks had nothing to do with the financial crisis, which probably maybe 10 firms were sort of involved in, 10 or 15, but in fact the other 6,000. It's just choking the whole credit banking system, frankly. So that's it. What's happening is sort of what I guess they wanted was to really substitute our system with something that looks a lot more like Europe, I suppose. So that's what we're getting. And I hope you're all happy with that. And if you're not happy with it, there's something you can do about it. But.
Okay, so Chuck, I've got to race through here. You've got to race with me. Let me ask you a couple very, very practical ones. How worried should investors be about inflation right now? And what would you recommend as an inflation hedge?
Well, I, in my age category, I worry about it a lot because it is a big factor. Inflation, the risk of inflation is enormous. However, right now, inflation doesn't seem to be that bad, but it is happening in your very face. Your value of money goes down every day. And that's the policy of the Federal Reserve. They lie to you. They lie to you that, oh, we're going to have really stable currency. It's not true. If you look at any comparative thing, the value of currency has gone down every day over the last really 3 years. As it goes on.
Hedge and hedge. Huh? What would you recommend as a hedge?
Oh, as a hedge. I truly believe that the best hedge, and probably the only hedge, for someone who's, you know, over 50, is probably equities in great companies, great names that you use every day. You know, look in your closet, look in your refrigerator. Great names, just buy them, the ones that pay really good dividends, or brand names, stick with those things. Obviously have your fixed income thing, which you're going to be really hurt by inflation, but great companies have a way of adjusting and handling inflation over the longer term. But there's really not too many places to hide. I mean, some people think gold's a great place to hide. I wouldn't travel down that. I think there's enormous risk in buying a whole, put your whole portfolio in gold.
And if we're, Chuck, let's talk about, what advice would you have for philanthropic investors right now, and how would it change endowment versus institutional versus individual?
Well, I think the only strategy you can have, frankly, is to be broadly diversified. And that means lots of equities. And in my particular case, I use not just American equities, I use international equities. But be broadly diversified. This is the time, and nobody really knows what's going to happen tomorrow. You just don't know. And so the only way to handle what you don't know is make sure you're adequately diversified. It's not a time to play a hero at all, I don't think. And, you know, the entrepreneurs made it years ago. They took enormous risks. And now it's incumbent upon you to make sure that you sort of keep your relative value of your portfolio, of your endowment, whatever it might be. And the only way to do that, I think, is be broadly diversified.
And you mentioned international investing, which you've always been a proponent of. What economies?
Well, I think, you know, with some emphasis right now, it'd certainly be in, you know, from Asia, you can trust China, which is very difficult at times, on down to Australia, I think Singapore, some of the Indian thing. But those are not easy. Use mutual funds, use professional managers, be diversified in those particular areas. It's not easy to do that. It's much easier to do it in America, and because you know the names, you know the brand names and things like that.
I'm going to ask you one more that I know Adam wants me to ask, and that is, and then we'll open it up to questions. Can you speak a little bit about the significance of the donor-advised funds? Am I getting that right? Schwab Charitable.
You are getting that right.
It's a huge, know what it is, I just don't know what to call it.
Donor-advised funds are obviously have been had enormous growth, and there Schwab has a donor advised fund, Fidelity, Vanguard, and so forth. Every community has a donor advised fund through their community. Your community funds, foundations there. We have them in California, of course, and I'm sure all your communities have them, and they're a great positive force. But in our case, I can speak to that, we have probably 100,000 people who use it. It's fantastic for people who don't want to do foundations.
$3 billion in assets I think your Schwab Charitable has
about $3 billion in assets, and we give, I know it seems like we give about 50% of it away. I mean, we, the people who own that, they just use Schwab as the vehicle to put the money in, they can put certificates in, cash in, and then they manage it themselves from their own computer, so to speak, and we send checks out, and it's really a very efficient way.
How is the explosive growth in these funds, how is that affecting the world of philanthropy?
Well, I think it's increased the number of people who give. And I think it's increased to some degree the number of dollars that go to the recipients of these charities, but it definitely has increased the number of people give. And I think that's probably a great outcome. We make it real easy for people to give. And the average sort of gift in there might be $5,000. The average account might be $150,000, something like that. That's overweighted by some very large ones. So my guess is the real median level might be about $50,000. But, you know, what an easy way for people, the average person, to give money is through that vehicle.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.